What if humanity's entire story wasn't just, a straight line of events in a history book? What if it was more like a huge living library, sort of humming with knowledge, scattered across continents, across millennia, just waiting for us to remember it? Today, we're diving deep into 300,000 years of human history, but not like you usually hear it. We're looking at it through this lens of a coherence-first, life-grounded narrative. Our guide for this is a really unique piece of work. It's called Remembering the Living Library, a coherence-first, life-grounded history of humanity. And what's really interesting is it's a collaboration between Bechara Saheli, MD, and OpenAI GPT-5, dated September 2025. It offers a very fresh perspective.
It really does. What's so illuminating, I think, is how it completely reframes our past. It helps us see that knowledge isn't just locked up in text. It's actually encoded in, well, in everything. In ancient chants, celestial calendars, these intricate cosmograms, even just everyday ritual practices. So this deep dive, it's kind of a shortcut for you to understand how these shared human archives emerged, how they spread, how they were sometimes suppressed, often painfully so, and yet how they managed to survive. And ultimately, it poses this big question: how can we become better stewards of this incredible inheritance, for the future?
Okay, yeah, let's maybe break down a couple of key ideas we'll be bumping into. So when we say a distributed living library, what we're picturing is, well, all human knowledge, not just printed stuff, but knowledge embedded in songs, in sacred places, the land itself, our traditions, right?
Exactly. And then there's that term epistemicides. It's a powerful word. It means the deliberate destruction, the suppression of entire ways of knowing, like burning libraries, yes, but also destroying a whole worldview.
Wow. But despite that destruction, something amazing happened. Symbolic continuity. You mean like core patterns of meaning just kept bubbling up again?
Precisely. These fundamental symbols and structures persisted. And all this leads towards this really profound idea the source raises: becoming a custodian species, actively taking care of this collective wisdom.
Okay, so I guess the big question for you listening is, where did this incredible library even begin?
Right, our journey starts way back. We're talking the dawn of our species, Homo sapiens, maybe around 300,000 BCE. And we need to forget that old idea of a single origin point, like a Garden of Eden. The research points to something more dynamic, a continent-wide network of interconnected populations across Africa. Think of it less like one river source and more like a braided river of becoming, always flowing, changing, adapting.
Exactly.
And what really set our species apart, according to this work, wasn't just, bigger brains or better tools. It was this thing called recursive thinking. That's the uniquely human knack for encoding meaning in stuff, in material form, creating symbols that stand for something else, or symbols that even reflect on themselves. Think about those amazing ochre-stained artifacts from Blombo's cave. Some are 75,000 years old. They weren't just decorations. This was early humans literally weaving experience into layered narratives, sharing understanding, building collective memory way before writing existed.
That's incredible. It means we weren't just like getting by. We were actively building meaning, creating what the source terms technologies of belonging. And these aren't gadgets, right? They're symbolic practices that literally held communities together, like those engraved ochre tablets you mentioned, or the earliest shell beads found at Tafirol, even intentional burials, laying ancestors to rest with ochre, shells, tools. These were huge acts of meaning making, weren't they? Solidifying identity, shared stories.
Absolutely. And this symbolic ability flowed right into what became our earliest ecological memory systems. Story, song, dance. These weren't just, fun things to do. They were living libraries of ancestral wisdom. Through what the source calls proto-myths, stories involving figures like the serpent, the river, the sun, the ancestor people connected themselves to the cosmos. They used these forms to pass down critical information about the environment, their history, their place in the grand scheme of things.
So life wasn't seen as just a bunch of separate things, but this intricate living web, kinship, which led to this idea of sacred ecology and reciprocity, a way of being that really got that deep interdependence.
Totally. And the earliest coherence frameworks, how a society makes sense of itself and its world, you see them beautifully in indigenous African epistemologies, like Ubuntu in Southern Africa. People often translate it as "I am because we are." But it's more than just a nice saying, right? It's a deep framework. It aligns your interstate, your social bonds, the ecological rhythms, all into one living system. It shows how ancient societies were actually designed to sustain the whole ecosystem, not just humans.
Okay, so from this African cradle, humanity starts moving. The first great journeys, out of Africa, maybe starting around 70,000 years ago. And these weren't just random walks. We see this really fast dispersal, mostly along the Indian Ocean corridor. People reached places like Walapuram in India and Majidbebi in Australia incredibly quickly. It's pretty mind-blowing that all non-African populations alive today come down from just a few thousand of those early travelers.
It is. And the key thing to grasp is they didn't just carry their bodies and tools. They carried entire living archives of survival knowledge. It was their symbolic intelligence embedded in their stories, their songs, their crafts that let them adapt and thrive in all these incredibly different new places. It was like their mental toolkit for exploring the world.
And naturally, as they spread out, they met others. Encounter and exchange became part of the story. We see it in our genes, right?
Yeah, exactly. Genomic studies show pretty much all non-African people today have between 1 and 4% Neanderthal DNA. And some groups in Oceania and parts of Southeast Asia carry up to 6% Denisovan ancestry. This isn't just biology. It hints at deep histories of cultural mixing, technological sharing, too. And this era also saw the amazing birth of maritime sciences. I mean, successfully sailing to Sahul, that's ancient Australia and New Guinea, combined around 60,000 years ago, that's incredible. That wasn't luck. It took deliberate planning, coordinated cooperation, and really sophisticated navigational skill. They learned the winds, the tides, the patterns of birds and fish. And crucially, they encoded all that complex knowledge into story, song, and ritual so it can be passed down accurately for generations.
What really jumps out at me is how these symbolic continuities keep appearing across continents.
Yeah.
It's striking. You look at the painted caves like Chauvet and Lascaux in Europe, then the Apollo 11 cave in Namibia, the Guion rock art in Australia. There's this explosion of symbolic expression, and often you see similar themes, similar visuals.
Absolutely. Across all these incredibly diverse places, you find recurring symbolic structures like serpentine forms flowing alongside rivers or concentric circles, triadic compositions. Those serpent water symbols are almost everywhere. You see them in Australia's Dreamtime with the rainbow serpent and in loads of African traditions too. Even flood myths, which encode all sorts of ecological and metaphysical ideas, seem to be another layer of this global symbolic connection. These are like humanity's deep shared ways of making meaning.
So then, as the climate stabilizes, moving into the Holocene epoch, we see humans start building differently. Settlements, calendars, and sacred sites emerge. Göbekli Tepe in Turkey is just mind-blowing, dating back to maybe 9600 BCE. These huge stone enclosures aligned with the stars.
Right.
It really suggests that maybe shared ritual, this deep meaning-making, might have actually come before large-scale farming took hold.
That impulse to sort of map the heavens onto the earth, it just pops up everywhere. These megalithic architectures, I think Nabta Playa in the Sahara, Stonehenge in England, Chanquilo over in Peru, they all show these incredibly sophisticated understandings of solar and lunar cycles. They weren't just temples, they were like giant memory devices, weren't they? Tracking time, marking seasons, anchoring their whole view of the cosmos in stone.
And back in Africa, there was this real flourishing of Pan-African symbolic systems. The continent really stayed this crucible for some of humanity's most sophisticated symbolic frameworks. You mentioned Nabta Playa had precise solstitial markers that points to ancient astronomy, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And you see this complexity in systems like Ifa from Yoruba cosmology. It's not just beliefs. It's a highly complex combinatorial divination framework. It encodes vast amounts of ecological knowledge, ethical guidance, ancestral history. Or think about Incibidi, that protoscript from the Cross River region, or the really rich Adinkra symbols from Okan traditions in West Africa and sacred geometry. You see it shaping structures from Great Zimbabwe all the way to the rock churches of Lalibela and, of course, the pyramids of Giza. These weren't separate subjects like we think of them, science, art, spirituality. They were all woven together.
And from these African centers and others, knowledge radiated globally. Like the Indus Valley cities, Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro. We still can't read their script, but it's clear they were part of a huge distributed semiotic network sharing trade, culture, meaning across a massive area.
And then you leap across the Pacific. Those Polynesian navigation chants, they were just stunning examples of living oceanic archives. They weren't just songs people sang for fun. They encoded precise, detailed knowledge of the stars, the tiny changes in ocean swells, the flight paths of birds. It allowed navigators to cross enormous stretches of open ocean, passing this knowledge down through generations using story, song, and ritual. It's an entire knowledge system embedded in performance. Incredible.
Moving forward a bit, roughly 3000 to 500 BCE, the source highlights Africa, particularly Kemet, the Nile Valley, as this powerful rootstock for knowledge. It wasn't just another empire, it was this extraordinary synthesis, wasn't it? Ecological adaptation, math, cosmology, social structure, all woven together.
Kemet really did integrate deep observation with profound symbolic understanding. Their mystery sciences, like in medicine, you see it in the Ebers Papyrus, showed incredible anatomical and pharmaceutical knowledge, but always within a holistic view. Their geometry, their math, you see the pyramids, Luxor, Karnak. It wasn't just practical engineering. It was sacred, tied to celestial cycles, and holding it all together was Mott, that core principle of truth, balance, reciprocity, justice. It governed everything.
And this wasn't happening in a vacuum. There were these incredible corridors of flow, the Nile Valley, Mesopotamia, the Indus Basin. They weren't isolated. They formed this dynamic triangular exchange.
Exactly. Calendars, crops, ways of understanding the cosmos, symbolic ideas. They were moving, mixing, influencing each other. And beyond that, you had sophisticated monsoon belt networks connecting the Swahili coast in East Africa with Gujarat in India and Oman. These were advanced maritime systems spanning huge distances. But what's also striking is that it wasn't just one place dominating. You had these parallel centers of wisdom blooming all over. In India, the Vedic tradition flowered, giving us things like the Vedanga Jyotisha, the ancient astronomy text, and the concept of the grand yuga cycles, mapping cosmic time. In China, you get the powerful ideas of yin and yang, the five phase or wuxing system, all deeply tied into Taoist alchemy and understanding natural flows. Mesoamerica, the incredible precision of the mile-long count calendar, the ritual architecture like Chichen Itza. And across the Pacific, Polynesians were still using their star compass for epic voyages.
It's just amazing to think about, isn't it? All these cultures, so far apart geographically, all engaged in these profound, similar acts of meaning-making, charting the stars, building frameworks for how to live well. What really stands out to you about that shared human drive?
Okay, so we have this incredibly rich, interconnected web of knowledge, but then things start to fray. The source talks about seeds of fracture emerging from around 500 BCE up to about 1500 CE. This includes the axial turn, roughly 800 to 200 BCE, a time when societies across the globe started asking really radically new questions about reality, consciousness, justice. Think of the Upanishadic sages in India, Confucius and Lao Tzu in China, Greek philosophers, the Hebrew prophets.
Yeah, and these periods definitely generated some shared planetary themes, ideas about compassion, justice, balance, liberation that resonate even today. But as the source points out, this era also planted seeds of fracture. Those symbolic systems, which had been so deeply embedded in ritual and connection to the land, started becoming more abstracted. Knowledge began to pull away from its living, breathing context. And a big part of that was appropriation and rebranding, wasn't it? Like how Kemetian knowledge, Egyptian knowledge, was often sort of repackaged and presented as if it all started with Greek philosophy.
Exactly. The famous Library of Alexandria, for example. Yes, it was a place of incredible synthesis, gathering knowledge from everywhere. But it also became a site of epistemic displacement knowledge being taken out of its original context, sometimes de-Africanized, reframed. The source describes this as the disembedding of logos from mythos. It's like reason getting separated from ritual, text from land, knowledge from ecology. It was a huge shift away from those integrated worldviews we were just talking about, moving towards more fragmented ways of knowing.
And the consequence was memory scattered, lineages persist. We saw devastating epistemicides, the burning of the Library of Alexandria is the famous one, but also the destruction of Nalanda Mahavihara, the great Buddhist university in India, and the Spanish missionaries systematically burning the Maya codices in the Americas. These weren't just book burnings, they were attempts to wipe out entire worlds of understanding.
Terrible losses. And yet, memory is incredibly tough. We see these amazing survivals, like the Timbuktu manuscripts in Mali, hidden and protected by families for centuries, or the Polynesian navigation chants, kept alive orally, maintaining that vast oceanic knowledge. The Ifa divination corpus in West Africa, passed down mouth to ear for millennia. It really makes you ask, doesn't it? What makes some knowledge systems more resilient than others? Often it seems to be that deep connection to living practice, to community, to embodiment. It makes it harder to just erase.
Then we move into a period the source calls the Atlantic Fracture, roughly 1500 to 1900 CE. And this is dominated by enslavement and extraction. The transatlantic slave trade, forcibly tearing over 12 million Africans from their homes. The source emphasizes this wasn't just a demographic catastrophe. It was a profound epistemic, ecological, and cosmological rupture. It shattered communities, knowledge systems, connections to land, everything.
And those plantation economies, they essentially functioned as brutal laboratories for global capitalism. They turned African bodies into commodities and land into yield per acre. This embedded these deeply extractive logics right into the foundations of the emerging global system. The echoes of that are still incredibly powerful today.
And a key tool was cultural erasure, but it was met with this incredible syncretic resistance. Languages were deliberately suppressed, rituals banned, spiritual practices forbidden. Even the drum, which is such a vital tool for memory and communication in many African cultures, was often outlawed.
But resistance absolutely flourished, often in hidden ways. You had maroon societies, communities formed by escaped enslaved people who actively preserved African languages, ecological practices, and spiritual traditions in remote areas. You had Creole languages emerge, blending roots to create new forms of communication and identity. And African spiritualities adapted brilliantly through syncretic forms. Think Vodou in Haiti, Candomblé in Brazil, Santeria in Cuba. They often mask ancestral knowledge and coherence within, say, Catholic saints or rituals. Ingenious survival.
Alongside the direct violence, there were also these pervasive colonial epistemicides, things like missionary education, which was explicitly designed to disrupt the intergenerational transmission of indigenous knowledge, replacing it with European ways, and the museum capture, taking sacred objects, artifacts out of their living cultural context, shipping them to Europe and displaying them as primitive curiosities, stripping them of their power and meaning.
Yeah, and tied into all of that was the systematic whitewashing of African contributions to science and technology. Major innovations in medicine, metallurgy, math, architecture, from the Nile Valley sacred geometries we talked about, to the complex combinatorial logic in Ifa, were often just erased from the historical record, attributed to Europeans, or dismissed altogether in the dominant Western story.
Which brings us neatly to modernity and meaning collapse, roughly 1700 to 1950 CE. A central theme here is how nature rendered inert. The European Enlightenment, thinkers like Descartes, Newton, their ideas fundamentally shifted how many people saw the world. Nature wasn't a living cosmos anymore, but more like a machine, a mechanistic resource to be analyzed and controlled.
Right, and that philosophical shift directly paved the way for fossil-fueled industrialization. The Earth, which for millennia had been seen as a living partner, a participant in the human story, was increasingly treated as just an object, something to be mastered, measured, and mined. That paradigm shift has had massive ecological and cultural fallout we're still dealing with.
And going along with that was a powerful narrative capture. Eurocentric history writing basically positioned Western civilization as the pinnacle, the sole innovator, the main inheritor of all meaningful knowledge. It effectively sidelined or erased the contributions and deep histories of countless other cultures.
Yet, even through all these intense pressures, these periods of fracture, African epistemologies showed incredible resilience. They kept going through oral traditions, ritual practices, symbolic grammars, and sometimes literally hidden away, like those Timbuktu manuscripts. Memory, especially when it's embodied, when it's held by a community, proved really hard to completely extinguish.
But then maybe the tide starts to turn. We get to memory rekindled from around 1950 CE up to 2025. This is the era of decolonization and diaspora healing. You see powerful post-colonial independence movements across Africa, Asia, the Caribbean, Ghana, Algeria, Jamaica, South Africa, so many others. You see the rise of Pan-Africanism with thinkers and leaders like Nkrumah, Nyerere, Du Bois, even movements like Rastafari, all powerful efforts to reclaim identity, history, and agency.
And technology starts playing a role, too, in digital repatriation. It's a new way of reclaiming heritage. Those Timbuktu manuscripts are being digitized, making centuries of Islamic and African scholarship available globally. The vast Ifa divination corpus, all 256 odu, or chapters, is becoming more accessible online and in print. And community projects, like the Hukulea Voyaging Canoe, are using modern methods to document and preserve Polynesian navigation chants and techniques. It's about restoring access, yes, but also about restoring meaning and community control.
What's really exciting, I think, is the resurgence of indigenous epistemologies. We're seeing traditional ecological knowledge tech being recognized and integrated with modern planetary science in really powerful ways.
Absolutely. Think about Aboriginal Australian songlines. They're not just mythology. They're sophisticated maps of ecosystems, water sources, species behavior, or Inuit knowledge of sea ice dynamics, which is proving crucial for understanding climate change in the Arctic, or Amazonian cosmologies offering deep insights into biodiversity and sustainable living. These aren't just ancient relics. They're living, relevant knowledge systems.
Yeah.
And you see this resurgence directly feeding into climate justice movements, often led by indigenous peoples and voices from the African diaspora, from the resistance at Standing Rock against pipelines to Pacific Island nations demanding climate reparations for rising sea levels. These movements are fundamentally challenging those old extractive logics and pushing for regenerative, life-centered alternatives. It feels like a potential paradigm shift, you know,
yeah.
A move towards reintegrating human life with the planet's life.
So looking ahead, remembering the Living Library from 2025 onward, a big focus is restoring custodianship. This involves concrete things like initiatives the source mentions, such as a transatlantic bridge of hope, trying to heal the spiritual and cultural wounds between Africa and the Caribbean. And crucially, it means the actual repatriation of artifacts, archives, and custodial authority, getting sacred objects and ancestral knowledge back from Western institutions to the communities they belong to.
And if you zoom out, the bigger possibility here is to really reweave symbol, science, and story. To consciously integrate the deep, life-grounded wisdom of indigenous cosmologies with the analytical tools of modern systems thinking, the aim is to maybe uncover a kind of planetary grammar of coherence, to see those recurring patterns like the spiral, the triad, that serpent water symbol we talked about, showing up across different traditions and even in scientific understandings of living systems.
Ultimately, this whole deep dive feels like a powerful call to action, doesn't it? Towards becoming a custodian species. And the source presents this not just as a nice idea, but as a survival imperative, a necessary shift away from extraction towards reciprocity, away from domination towards partnership with life.
Exactly. It's about fundamentally redesigning things, our economies, our governance around life value coherence, moving towards what they call regenerative reciprocity, and consciously safeguarding the unburnable library, that entwined archive of our collective memory and the biosphere itself. It's about recognizing that our deepest, most valuable inheritance is actually our species' capacity to align human thriving with planetary health.
So reflecting on this journey through humanity's vast, distributed living library, it really shows our story isn't some straight line. It's much more like a spiral, constantly circling back, reweaving the past into the future. And despite all those fractures, colonialism, epistemicide, these living libraries, whether they're in our songs, our stories, our sacred places, our bodies, they've shown this incredible, stubborn resilience.
Yeah, they have. And the call now feels urgent, doesn't it? To consciously step up and become that custodian species. It really means shifting our whole way of being. From taking to giving back, from dominating to participating, from feeling separate to knowing we belong. It means actively tending this living archive, both our collective memory and the living earth.
So maybe a final thought for you, listening to this deep dive. As you think about this idea of a distributed living library, what specific patterns, symbols, stories, or even just ways of being in your own life, your traditions, maybe your local environment, what resonates with this ancient coherence? How could you personally, consciously, tend to those connections? How could you become a steward of this unburnable library right where you are in your own unique way? Thank you for joining us on the deep dive. Keep exploring that vast, interconnected story of human knowledge.